listening to a program produced in 2010 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. If a book on the great equations could engage this self-confessed mathematics phobic cultural programs director, you know the author is onto something. I happen to be the younger sister of a brother who was considered quite a precocious mathematician, and when he was 5 and I was 2, he locked me in a closet and tried to teach me square roots, which is, I wager, is the source of my problematic relationship to mathematics. Robert Crease's wonderful book takes readers on a tour through 10 great equations, 10 of the most important victories in our long struggle to understand the world we live in. He reveals the personal struggles of their ingenious originators and the impact that that work had on civilization. He locates the equations in the panoramic sweep of Western history, showing that they are as integral to their time and place of creation as our great works of art. He's a wonderful writer with a great gift for metaphor. In his chapter on Euler's equation, he writes, "Mathematics often grows in an indirect way, the way that many cities do. Certain scattered settlements spring up first with little interaction among one another. These settlements eventually cluster around one another, becoming neighborhoods. But because they form almost at random, they are poorly adapted, and little commerce takes place. A visionary leader emerges who understands each neighborhood, and by renaming some streets and buildings, others between key centers allows them to grow into a greater structure that is simultaneously more simplified, organized, and unified. This is the role," he says, "that Euler played in 18th century mathematics." I just love that, and I think you will love this book as well. Professor Robert P. Crease is the chairman of the Department of Philosophy at Stony Brook University, New York. He is the organizer of the Trust Institute at Stony Brook, which presents interdisciplinary programs about contemporary issues. His articles and reviews have appeared in the Atlantic Monthly, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Newsday, and elsewhere. And he writes a monthly column, Critical Point, on the Social Dimensions of Science for Physics World magazine, which many of you might have read. Are there any Physics World readers in the room, perhaps? He is the author of a number of books, including The Prism and the Pendulum, The Second Creation, The Philosophy of Expertise, and several others. And in conversation with Robert Crease tonight, we have another distinguished thinker and educator. Larry Swanson is the Appleman Professor of Biological Sciences and a member of the Neuroscience Research Institute at USC, where he directs a laboratory investigating brain systems that control motivation and emotion. His recent book, Brain Architecture, Understanding the Basic Plan, presents a new theory of nervous system organization, and his Atlas Brain Maps is in its third edition. He is a fellow of the prestigious American Academy of Arts and Sciences. This is the second Aloud program that Larry has moderated, and he's even agreed to do a third in April. Don't miss it. We are really delighted. And after that, and with no further ado, please welcome two great thinkers, Robert P. Crease and Larry Swanson, to the LA Public Library. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Louise, for that wonderful introduction, and also for inviting me to this very distinguished series. And thank you to Larry for being the moderator. I thought I'd begin by just talking a little bit about how I came to do this book, and this is the answer. Not so much the Christmas tree, but it was this particular ornament that really got me. You know, that really stopped me. Somewhere, some ornament manufacturer was tired of doing Santa Clauses and reindeer and stuff, and thought, "What am I going to do on my next ornament? I know E equals MC squared, and that will." And I'll be able to sell enough to make it worthwhile. Well, that really stopped me, you know, because clearly the equation here is not serving as a tool. Nobody is going to calculate with it. No, it's not going to be used in any lab. Well, why is it there? And I thought it's there because it's a symbol somehow. But if it's a symbol, what does it mean? And so that got me thinking about the symbolic character of equations. Certain equations become symbols, or not just scientific tools, but they do cultural work. They're symbols. And just so that you don't have to actually go out and buy the book, I thought I'd list the equations that I talk about here in the book and their symbolic meaning. I chose 10 of them that seem to have interesting stories in them, interesting journeys, I call them in the book, from the time just before the equation, when the inventors were motivated by some sort of dissatisfaction to look into something, to the creation of the equation, to afterwards. And I thought I'd just quickly, before I start talking with Larry, just go over them. The equations, believe it or not, show up in popular culture all the time. But the Pythagorean theorem sort of becomes the symbol of proof itself. You know, when somebody says, well, what's the meaning of a mathematical proof? Well, the Pythagorean theorem, that's what I mean. It's a proof that symbolizes proof, I write in the book. F equals ma, the internet is a wonderful place, don't you think? I mean, you can find all sorts of stuff on it. F equals ma is the journey to that equation took over 2,000 years and, you know, culminated in the Principia by Sir Isaac Newton, 1687. And what's interesting is even in the Principia, Newton didn't write it out in this particular form, the form in which we know it, but wrote it out in words. It wasn't put in the form of an equation until Euler, about a century afterwards. The third equation I talk about is the famous equation of universal gravitation, and I talk a little bit about the apple story, which has the air of legend about it, but actually there was something to it. Isaac Newton himself seems to have started the legend. E to the I pi plus 1 equals 0 is another equation. It's a little bit topical in the Los Angeles area, if I recall right, because you had this equation was actually introduced as evidence in a criminal trial here about 5 years ago. Maybe Larry and I can talk about that. It's the next equation I talk about is the law of entropy. Entropy itself is a scientific concept that appears a lot in popular culture. Tom Stoppard uses it in some of his plays. Thomas Pynchon has a short story entitled Entropy, and that chapter is a wonderful chapter. I describe how it originated as if the story were a drama. The Maxwell's equations too, that Richard Feynman once called the most significant event of the 19th century, in comparison to which the U.S. Civil War will vanish into insignificance. Equals MC squared, of course, which I call the celebrity equation. It's actually literally been on the cover of Time magazine. The Einstein's general theory of relativity. And then two equations concerning quantum mechanics, one Schrodinger's equation and the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. And as Louise showed me earlier this evening, these last two equations are actually on the stairs leading up to the side door of this building. I don't know if any of you noticed that, but they're both there. So I was very, very interested to see that. So the book is basically about not about the mathematics of the equation so much, or even about the science. Although in the book, I mix a little bit of science with science history, with philosophy, with popular culture. But it's about the meanings that these equations have come to have in popular culture.
Thank you, Bob, and thank you so much for coming. It's been a real pleasure meeting you today, and I loved reading your book. Louise has given a brilliant overview. We've had a nice little PowerPoint presentation. You know, but basically, to me, what I loved about the book was the ease with which you sort of bridge this gap between science and the humanities, how to get people interested. You know, I'm a biologist, but like most people, an equation to me is like a spider. You know, the minute I see one, there's a reaction to it that I just have. But, you know, he starts by something that everybody can relate to and actually understand, and that's 1 plus 1 equals 2, which is an equation, right? Absolute certainty. Now, I noticed there's nothing in the book about the history of 1 plus 1 equals 2. Is it so far, so elementary that
it's... So far back, yeah. It's so important because it provides the format, the structure for other equations to follow.
It's way back. So I guess really going back to the Greeks, Pythagoras, let's say the Pythagorean theorem is the first great equation that you can begin to see the history of.
Yeah, but there too, there's a difference between the rule, c squared equals a squared plus b squared, and the proof. So the rule was known way back in history. The ancient Babylonians knew it. The Egyptians knew it. The Greeks knew it. But the proof itself is something different. The Greeks seem to have originated, and not necessarily Pythagoras. We're not really sure about that Pythagoras was the first. But the Greeks actually laid out the proof. That first chapter is one of my favorite chapters because I get a chance to write about philosophy, because one of the first proofs is in Plato's Meno, where Socrates talks. Socrates is trying to demonstrate to this student Meno what knowledge is all about, and Meno's a little bit slow and he's not quite getting it, and so Socrates says, "I know, I'll show you how you acquire knowledge," and he draws a slave boy forth and proves in a stick in the sand a version of the Pythagorean theorem.
That's beautiful, the geometry of it. So I guess the geometry, where did Euclid fit in exactly historically? He was after Pythagoras.
Euclid's after.
Did he sort of formalize the whole approach to like a rigorous mathematics?
Yeah, the proof in the Meno, which is the first extant piece of early Greek mathematics, is of a version of the Pythagorean theorem using an isosceles triangle. But Euclid is something quite different. It's much more systematic, and it comes about 100 years after Aristotle.
What was one thing that was fascinating to me was you have this proof of the Pythagorean theory, and that you start following this through history, and you realize they're still trying to figure out new proofs to this. There's actually more than one way to prove some of these theorems.
Well, that's what's so wonderful about the chapter to me, is that the Pythagorean theorem seems to exert a kind of magic over people. I mean, Einstein talks about how he was the moment when he was 12 when he first saw the proof of the Pythagorean theorem, and this really impressed him. Here was something that was true, not just for one triangle, not just for this triangle, but for all triangles. And it seemed to indicate a level of knowledge beyond the here and now that really attracted him. Or I referred it to George Frazer, the novelist George Frazer, who was in World War II in Burma, and Japanese soldiers were all around, and one of his comrades was on the verge of going crazy and says, "Show me something that'll take me out of here." And so Frazer proves the Pythagorean theorem in the sand with a bayonet, and this was just what his comrade wanted.
This is incredible. You know, this is one of the beauties of mathematics, is this incredible cast of characters that you can follow through history. You can raise Einstein in talking about the Pythagorean theorem, and the fact that here's this 12-year-old kid with this, I guess there's some math whizzes out here tonight, but, you know, how many of us actually have this innate interest, actually, in an understanding that could get that pleasure out of an equation at age 12? Was this something about Einstein, something about his personality?
Well, I don't know. A lot of people get the... There's a delight in the sense of a delight in being able to prove something and confirm something that you know to be true.
Well, it's true with 1 + 1 = 2, I guess, as a little kid. That's a very powerful thing to learn, isn't it?
But you mentioned a moment ago the fact that there are different proofs of the Pythagorean theorem, and that really fascinated me while I was writing this. That there was an American who, about 1900 or so, began collecting proofs of the Pythagorean theorem and became obsessed with proofs and seeing how many different ways you could prove it, and published one edition, then another edition. And on the web now, there's a Greek person who has assembled over 500 different proofs of the Pythagorean theorem. So here's the question. Why do you need more than one proof? Why isn't one proof enough?
Are they all equal?
I mean... And some proofs, of course, look like different proofs, but actually they're just versions of the same. But there are really very different ways of proving it. But why? And I think the answer is something about finding a new proof. It doesn't contribute to... Well, what does it contribute? It doesn't contribute overall to mathematics, but it does... It does show you something about the joy of doing mathematics.
It's the aha moment of discovery.
The aha moment, the creativity, the play in mathematics.
And then other people can actually appreciate that it's been done. You know, so then you move along. I mean, there are endless people involved, but, you know, you come then, of course, to these great geniuses, Galileo and Newton. A little bit closer. You know, you come now to these incredible geniuses that everybody's heard of, Galileo and Newton. And what made after was Galileo, I think, was one of the absolute greatest since Greek times. What actually made Galileo stand out so much from, say, the previous 500 years or so?
Wait a minute, Larry. Galileo isn't... There isn't a chapter on Galileo.
Well, he's in Newton. He figured in the Newton chapter.
Figures, right.
Because, you know, you did, you sort of, you did, I think you led into Newton by saying how he trumped Galileo a little bit. And yet Galileo had set sort of the stage for modern physics.
Right. Okay, the interesting thing about F equals MA is that it is a long journey, you know, from Aristotle's conception when there's no concept of speed or acceleration even. I mean, we now, concepts like velocity and acceleration are second nature to us. We live in a world of accelerometers and speedometers, and we're familiar with these notions. But Aristotle didn't have any of this, and the journey, no clocks. There were kinds of water clocks, but you can't estimate speed or acceleration with the naked eye. So the journey from Aristotle to Newton was a very long one, and Galileo was kind of the penultimate step with early notions of mass. That is a conception of a mass that's different from weight, but amount of stuff in an object that's not equivalent to weight, and the use of early application of mathematics to motion of objects. So, Galileo envisioned the infinite planes, early thought experiments. What would happen if resistance? If we didn't have resistance, how would objects move? And he used that as a basis for beginning to calculate equations of motion.
So you were talking about Aristotle having such a rich, detailed view of how the world worked in all of its complexities. And then you get finally to a Newton where it's greatly simplified, I think.
Because he focuses on one particular aspect. You know, Newton has this image of a horse dragging a weight tied to a rope in the Principia, and talks about the force and the mass and the resistance and so forth, but ask why is explain that motion. Well, if you ask that of Aristotle, Aristotle would say, well, who hooked up the weight to the, what is the weight? Who hooked it up? Why is the merchant taking it to market? Why are things sold at the market? So all of these kinds of explanations would factor into Aristotle, but for Newton was limited just to a particular set of questions, and that's part of his advance.
As I recall, you said one thing he did was sort of focus on the how more than the why.
Right, right.
Which is a really different, because we all ask, well, why did that happen? Why? And it was much for him, much more mechanism. How did it work?
And that's partly to do with his theology. God was the supreme ruler. Everything else was his subjects, was the God's subjects, including inanimate matter, and these inanimate matter obeyed laws just as subjects obey laws of rulers. Only the matter doesn't get to disobey laws like we humans do. So Newton, part of what's interesting about Newton is that concept of law was changed from something normative to something descriptive. It's not a law has to do with the ruler and subjects, But whereas we subjects have a chance to disobey, matter doesn't. Well, that's so the concept of law becomes something descriptive just about this time.
That's interesting. That's fair. So what about the apple? I mean, did that?
That has the ring of an invented story, a nice story, and it's familiar in pictures and so forth. And it's a great story. But if you look into it, it turns out that the inventor of the story, the sources all trace the story to Newton himself. That Newton said, well, I first had these ideas when I saw this apple on my mother's orchard. But, you know, it's like a lot of stories, there's complexities to it. It looks like Newton was in a battle with his nemesis Hooke as to who first came up with the inverse square law. And it looks like in telling the story, he was trying to backdate the story to 1667, long before Hooke. But the truth of the matter is pretty, because Newton, as you know from that chapter, he was not a generous, chatty guy. He was suspicious and paranoid. So if he were telling you a story, there was some purpose to it.
I see.
So he was probably trying to backdate this notion, historians think.
It worked.
And it worked. But probably the truth is that he began thinking about it, but he clearly didn't come up with the inverse square law, which is the famous law that of universal gravitation until two decades after that story would have taken place. So it probably started him off on a series of reflections that culminated in 1684, 1685.
Well, you say, and it's probably true, I guess, that the Principia really is maybe the greatest book of science and math.
Greatest single scientific treatise ever.
Well, that's an incredible statement to make. The gold standard... up until the end of maybe the 19th century, when people started seeing a few flaws in there that they couldn't really explain away.
But it just reoriented, reshaped everything.
Reoriented. And so one of the great...
And people actually read it. I mean, Thomas Jefferson had several copies in his library and actually... it's clear that he read it because he took notes in the margins. I mean, can you imagine any other president doing that?
Not in recent memory, no. Well, of course, and then, of course, we get to one of the most famous of all, Einstein, equals MC squared, who was, you tell some great stories about how his thinking, he started apparently thinking about some of these problems when he was like 16 or so, and just kept thinking. And I'm not sure exactly what his background. Did he go to university in mathematics? I've forgotten what his formal training was.
Oh, Einstein. he had formal training in mathematics, but he was young, 26, I think, when he was working on this problem. But what's interesting? Well, there's several interesting things about the equation. I call it a celebrity equation because, like a celebrity, it's something everybody knows, but nobody knows. Do you know what I mean? I mean, everybody's heard of it. The Dalai Lama says that that's the one equation that he knows. And, Maria Carey had entitled her album about it. There's a play about it. You've seen it. Actually, I didn't notice it on the steps today. Does anyone know if it's on the steps? I'm sure it's there someplace. But... So I trace how, in the original form, it wasn't written as equals MC squared. Different letters were used. And there's a corrective factor over the square root of 1 minus V squared over C squared. But that's completely dropped out in the public mind. So how did we get to associate it with equals MC squared and not the rest? And that's the story that I tell. And, of course, a lot has to do with the Manhattan Project. And when the Manhattan Project was... while the bomb was being completed, the heads of the Manhattan Project decided to ask to come up with a book about how the bomb was completed. That was headed by Smythe of Princeton, and that would explain to in public terms what had happened and the science behind it. And this was published shortly after the Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And that, in one of the early pages, uses the equation equals MC squared as just in that form and just in those terms. And from there, it wound up on the cover of of time.
It's a fascinating, incredibly important chapter in history. And I remember you writing that, say, in the 1920s, when people asked Einstein what the practical significance of this formula was, there was none, was there, at that point?
Starting about that time in cosmic ray and nuclear transformations, you started needing to use it to understand the changes in mass that were occurring.
But say in 1910 or 1906, it was incredibly theoretical at that point.
It was still, and it was kind of an afterthought, as he had written this long article, 1905, and then just the day he sent it off, he writes a friend saying, oh, I have this other afterthought, I'll do a short article about that, and that's the equation in which this version of equals mc squared appears.
And then they started basically discovering the nucleus of the atom and what neutrons and some of the parts, and then they started to maybe see that this equation explains some of the experimental data.
When radioactivity began to be discovered and explored in a quantitative way, it begins to become important for it. But actually, there's one other element that I wanted to mention about that equation, which is that, you know, when you see pictures of Einstein, real pictures of Einstein at a blackboard, it's covered with equations. But when you see popular images or cartoons of Einstein, there's only this one. It's only him and this one equation. So this equation is kind of a symbol. It symbolizes almost knowledge itself. It's like a Gnostic symbol. So it's, you know, in movies like Angels and Demons and what other movies? School of Rock. It's the equation used in School of Rock to indicate that the teacher really knows what he's doing. So it becomes the symbol of knowledge itself, and that's the kind of thing that I found fascinating in the book.
What actually got him started thinking about, what was the problem that actually got him going to come to E equals MC squared? What's the background? It didn't come out of nowhere.
Scientists, end of the 19th century, were between a rock and a hard place. Right. You had Maxwell's equations. And we skipped over Maxwell, but we'll have to get back to Maxwell.
Anybody want to hear about Maxwell?
I want to hear about Maxwell.
Well, why don't you take a minute?
No. Okay. Let me finish right. Einstein first. So Maxwell's equation said light travels at a certain speed, and Newton's equations said something different, that is, speed is relative to the frame of the observer, and the two collided. You couldn't figure out how to reconcile the two. What happened if you were moving at the speed of light? What would you see? And this was very perplexing to scientists at the time. A lot of scientists worked on it, Fitzgerald, the Irish physicist, Lorentz, and Einstein, too. And Einstein, the rest of them said, well, we could sort of save this if we could save the ether, the material in which light was moving, if you modify the laws of motion a little bit. And Einstein took a more ambitious attack and just tried to reconcile the two, the rock and the hard place, Maxwell's equations and Newton, from without thinking about the ether at all. And the one way it worked was to have the kinds of transformations that led to equals mc squared.
Well, this gets into something that comes up over and over in almost every chapter, and that is these great thinkers, when they came up with something new, came up with a new point of view about things. Now, you know, most of us, we get up in the morning and we say, the sun came up. Well, and the sun went down in the evening. That's not what happens. Actually, Copernicus showed us that the earth is actually going around the sun. The sun is not going around the earth. And so this was what the brilliance of Copernicus was, that he took a completely different point of view. You know, instead of the point of view of us on earth, he took a point of view of the solar system, the universe, whatever. And Newton did that. We talked a little about that. And I guess the same thing basically with Einstein, who was pretty much just these thought experiments, thinking about a different...
Yeah, and both of the equals mc squared and the equation for general relativity began with thought experiments. It was set in thinking.
What exactly is that, a thought experiment?
That's a good question. It's you imagine a situation, and you imagine what would happen in this situation. And it turns out what you think, if you describe the situation abstractly, what you think would happen in a common sense way collides with what the theory says. And so there must be some way of reconciling the two. And how would that be? So, I mean, Galileo had thought experiments already. What if you climbed to the top of a tall ship that was sailing and you dropped a cannonball? Would it land directly below the mast, or would it land back there? What would happen if you had a rider jumping off a cliff, and the rider and horse were sitting, were attached, and then they separated by just a little bit? Would they suddenly move a lot more slowly because they're lighter now, or would they move at the same speed? So there are lots of things where common sense would tell you two different things, and you wonder what's going on.
You know, in hindsight, they sort of sound obvious, but it's the brilliance of coming up with it in the first place that makes these incredible breakthroughs. It's not easy. We're all sort of entrenched in our way of thinking.
Well, that's part of what makes these people so. They had the genius to figure out what kind of situation reveals where the problem lies and how to put it in sharpest focus.
You know, then we come to the last guy that I want to talk about, and you go from essentially 1 + 1 = 2, absolute certainty, to uncertainty. This guy, Werner Heisenberg, who you have an incredibly interesting chapter on this guy who essentially had the appearance of one of these romantic poets, I guess. He was handsome and dashing, and yet had probably one of the most radical points of view imaginable in terms of how the world works.
Yeah, Heisenberg was very young. Quantum mechanics was put together by people who were extremely young, 24, 25, Dirac, Heisenberg, Pauli, they were all extremely young. And Heisenberg trusted mathematics. He thought the problem was we were trying to come up with a picture of what the subatomic world was like. Because we were everyone before him was trained in classical physics. They were trained to think in terms of pictures that you could. The subatomic world had a particle that would move at a particular place in a particular time, one place to another. But Heisenberg thought, no, we don't need pictures.
That's a very
we'll just rely on what's observable, what we can see, what from the outside. You know, it's like the subatomic world were a black box, and all we had out were experimental numbers, and we can't even there are no pictures. We cannot intuit what's happening.
That's a very counterintuitive way of looking at things.
Yeah, and a lot of people didn't like it, including Bohr. Bohr insisted, no, we have to be able to explain what's happening to. Have you seen the play Copenhagen?
Yes, yeah.
That's a marvelous play. Because Bohr, there you see, there's one point where Heisenberg says, Bohr says, well, it has to make sense. And Heisenberg says, no, it's mathematics. Mathematics is sense. That's what sense is. And Bohr doesn't like this idea. And Bohr is also insisting that everything has to be explainable to Marguerite, his wife. You know, we have to be able to explain these things to Marguerite.
This is what's great about this book.
That's what led to the birth of the Copenhagen interpretation.
So the world's great equations, and I thought I knew what an equation meant. You know, it says 1 + 1 = 2. A² + B² = C². Well, then you get to Heisenberg, and actually that doesn't have an equal sign in it, you know, on the two sides. It's equal to
or greater than, or sort of equal to.
There's uncertainty. It becomes a statistical answer instead of a definitive answer. I mean, this is a very, and as you point out, in culture now this has been taken to every extreme.
Yeah. Well, that's fascinating. In fact, I'm teaching a course this semester on the uncertainty principle in popular culture. I'm co-teaching it with a physicist, and most of the class consists of he and I arguing with each other, and occasionally the students get a chance to get...
So it shows up in sociology, doesn't it? I mean, it shows up everywhere.
Yeah, the New Age section of a bookstore, every other book has the word quantum or uncertainty in it, or it seems to symbolize something. It seems to symbolize what the psychologists call the observer effect, that the presence of an observer transforms what it is you're observing. But what's fascinating is references show up to it in everything from painting to sculpture to humor. There's an entire genre of uncertainty principle jokes. You know, Heisenberg stopped by the policeman, and the policeman asks, "Do you know how fast you're going?" And Heisenberg goes, "No, but I know exactly where I am." But that's just one. There's a whole series of jokes having to do with uncertainty of position and momentum. And
well, you know, we probably should clarify the situation a little bit. I mean, you know, you could take the extreme. We went from absolute certainty to absolute uncertainty. But there are limits to the domain where supposedly the uncertainty principle actually operates, right?
Right. It was developed to explain the amount of... sometimes there are variables in the subatomic world, such as position and momentum, energy and time, where if you're measuring them, the uncertainty with which you know one multiplied by the uncertainty with which you know another has to be greater than a certain amount. So they're not infinitely ascertainable in measurement. So it instills uncertainty as a basic feature of scientific law. So whereas before, 100 years earlier, uncertainty was... it was an estimate. It meant that you didn't know enough to understand this precisely. Used in mortality tables, birth rates, crime rates, and so forth. But now with Heisenberg, it's just at the center of physical theory itself.
Well, are there any skeptics actually who think there's something wrong with the Heisenberg equations? Let's say, wasn't Einstein's? I don't think you dealt with it, but I think he was skeptical, wasn't he? Or?
Yeah, that's a story that takes place largely after this. But okay. Einstein and Bohr had a long series of famous conversations in which they argued with each other about. Einstein would try to come up with Lindley's book Uncertainty has a good description of this, where Einstein would try to come up with the thought experiment, a counterexample. Look, here's an experiment you could do where you would wind up measuring the uncertainty precisely and you know the position precisely. Gotcha. And Bohr would be very upset and would come back a day or so later and point out the flaw in Einstein's own thought experiment, to show how the uncertainty principle was protected. So that was a famous series of conversations.
So you were talking about Heisenberg and how he essentially said, look, if we can't see it, that shouldn't be a limitation. We should still deal with it conceptually or mathematically.
Well, our habit was we ought to be able to picture it. We ought to be able to imagine what's happening with part of our definition of the real, the Newtonian definition of the real, was that things that exist are real, exist in a particular place at a particular time. And for the uncertainty principle in quantum mechanics, that's no longer so. That's what seems so troublesome.
You know, I get. Let's say if you go back to the 15th century when there were no microscopes or telescopes, and you know there was this whole world out there, the universe and the microscopic world. You couldn't see. There were effects you thought might be there, but there were an incredible number of wild theories to explain things before you actually had the tools. So you wonder if there will be tools eventually developed that might somehow approach these problems.
I know, but that's the amazing thing about quantum mechanics. No, I'm not a physicist. So, but my understanding is that there are proofs such as Bell's theorem where you can actually show no, there's no amount of additional information or additional tools will be able to eradicate that uncertainty.
All right, I guess that's it. You know, this is very. It's like the Pythagorean theorem. It's essentially proven. It's a very unsettling thing that there are just things that we cannot.
Well,
know.
That's why it becomes such an emblem in popular culture for uncertainty. It's. I mean, people knew about the observer effect before Heisenberg, but. But the fact now that there's an equation for it seems to legitimate the...
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's an absolutely fascinating book. So you must be working on another one. What's your next... have you got an interesting thing you're thinking about?
Several. Huh? Yeah. One of them is this course on uncertainty in popular culture. I mean, I taught this course several times before, and... For what I used to do in the beginning was what we used to do was assign students to find some sort of instance of the uncertainty principle or quantum the references to the quantum in popular culture outside physics. it could be biology or it could be computer engineering, but so someone come in with references from like literary criticism. If when you interpret a text, is that transforming a text in a way that's relevant to the uncertainty principle? Apparently, some literary critics have argued that religion uncertainty seems to preserve free will over determinism. There were a lot of theologians in the 30s who thought that the uncertainty quantum mechanics rescued human free will. The reference is all over, but after we did this twice, we got overloaded with these instances. We don't do it anymore. But
well, as a biologist, you know, did you run across any? I suppose in biology, one of the things would be the brain and free will, and,
yeah,
and you get down to that.
Microtubes. Does quantum mechanics play a role so that you get quantum effects in the microtubes? What's his name? The Emperor Penrose wrote about this. The possible role of quantum mechanics in consciousness. And he refers to another scientist whose name slipped my mind right now. But
Eccles or somebody, maybe?
Hammond? Hadamond? It'll come to me right after I switch off the microphones.
But anything else interesting in biology, or most of it related, say, to the mind?
Mostly related to that, from what I remember.
Well, we definitely look forward to the next book, and we'll have you back.
Thank you.
I think thank you, and we'll have time now for some questions. In fact, we've got plenty of time. We've got time for questions, and then we'll have a book signing. Yeah, down here in the front.
Yes, you said you wanted to talk about Maxwell.
Oh, well, there's a number of things I love about Maxwell. One of which was, each of these equations didn't come out of nowhere. They were created by people. And Maxwell, and I often just fell in love with the developers of these equations. And Maxwell was one of them. First of all, he died when he was 48. I mean, he was creating this huge scientific wave. And it crested after after his death, but some of the things that I wrote about in that chapter are, first of all, he was a great systematizer. He took bits and pieces from Faraday, from other people who wrote about magnetism and electricity, and systematized them into one package. And in putting them into one package, he did so in this huge book called the Treatise, Treatise on Electricity and Magnetism, which is about almost 1,000 pages long, which is very frustrating for historians of science to read, because he puts everything in it, but not in a neat way. And so one interesting thing about Maxwell is that Maxwell's equations weren't written by Maxwell himself. They were written by someone who came later named Heaviside, who was... he wrote for a magazine called The Electrician, and he looked at Maxwell's equations, found them far too cumbersome to use for making electrical calculations of the sort that people were having to do at that time. So just at this time, the undersea cable was being laid between United States and Europe, and he simplified Maxwell's equations into four. He took about 22 equations, simplified them into four, and restructured them. And those are what we know as Maxwell's equations. So Maxwell's equations weren't written by Maxwell himself, but by Heaviside. And Heaviside said, all I was trying to do was just clarify what was going on.
All scientists and mathematicians wish for somebody like that to come along.
Yeah, I just love that. I mean, that could have been said by any of the authors in this book. I was just trying to take something complex that it's all there, but I was just trying to simplify it. So that's one thing. Another thing that I like about Maxwell is that he used an analogy. It's one of the greatest uses of analogy in the history of science. He tried to build a model of what was happening, and literally build a model that still exists in the Science Museum in England someplace, of how electromagnetic waves might be traveling. And for this model then taught him something about those very waves. He learned through the very process of structuring this model. So then he wound up throwing the model away and kept the idea of electromagnetic waves that was born from the the model, and it's like he kept the baby but managed to throw out the bathwater. The other thing that I like about the Maxwell chapter is that it allows me to ride a hobby horse of mine, and my hobby horse is that I really get annoyed by so-called people's histories that don't mention science at all. And I, while doing this chapter, I looked in some histories of Britain and found famous ones and found no mention of Maxwell or, you know, Zinn's history of the United States. Scientists are almost completely absent from it. And yet these people changed human life more profoundly than any general. So Borlaug and others cured or saved the lives of more people than all the wars that these other histories than taken by all the wars that these other histories are about. So I got to ride a little hobby horse at the end about how these people changed human life more, and that historians ought to pay more attention to the role of science in the transformation of human life.
Let's see. Yeah, here. And then we'll get right behind next.
Do you have anything to say about whether mathematics is invented or discovered?
That's an interesting question, and I actually answer it by saying that it's both invented and discovered. That it's as if these things are both invented and discovered simultaneously. It's as if, you know, each of these chapters talks about a journey from before an equation exists to after an equation exists. And often in some of the more complex chapters like F equals MA, scientists, you know how when you take a journey, new sights come into vision and then they vanish off the landscape and new others come in. And when you reach your destination, the landscape looks entirely different. That's the sense I tried to give in writing some of these chapters. So I refer to them as being simultaneously invented and discovered.
So how would you define, like, a discovery is like a creative insight, whereas an invention is a series of steps that leads in it? How would you actually distinguish? What's the real difference between the two, I wonder?
Well, remember what I just said about Heaviside. Heaviside took something that was really complex and simplified it. So on the one hand, he was taking something that was already there and just bringing out its inherent structure. So that's both inventing it, that is adding something to what's there, and yet discovering it in that it was already there to begin with. It's, you know, I don't see a puzzle in that. I know it sounds like a puzzle between invention, which seems to draw something out of nowhere, and discovery, where you seem to find something that's already there preceding you. But the interesting thing that happens in each of these equations is that they're both, they have elements of both.
That makes sense. The gentleman right behind.
What will the next great equation be, and how will it affect human experience?
That's a good question. Anybody got any ideas? Again, I'm a philosopher. That's my background. I like to look and see. I like to look at the stories of what's already happened.
I think anybody that tries these predictions, they always fail. You know, otherwise you'd be inventing them. Huh?
Right. I wish I knew.
Let's see. I think we have a question. Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, you have an... Oh, okay. Just a sec.
Okay, gulp. I've been reading some cosmology, and it would seem to me that the Large Hadron Collider is going to try to answer a question about singularity, as we define it, the origin of the universe, which was apparently a pixel big and took place in a billionth of a second, and everything happened, including space and time. So that my suggestion would be that an equation that explains singularity or approaches an explanation of singularity might be the next.
Okay, right. That's the next equation that will wind up on the cover of Time is probably whatever the Large Hadron Collider comes up with.
Are there any... is there a core of mathematicians working on that problem that Is there a story there that's developing? Or
I don't know, but I'm going to the AAAS meeting, which starts tomorrow in San Diego. So, and I'm on a panel about the LHC, so ask me next weekend.
That's assuming it works, the machine.
It'll work.
It's running. Okay, up in the back here.
I have a two-part question. Sorry to hog up the time, but this first one is I want to direct it to the biologist.
Okay.
We've said that like Einstein and Newton and people like that, they think outside the box. And is there a reason why, is there a reason that dictates like why certain people think outside the box? Is it something evolutionary? You know, have you ever thought about that?
I don't think there's an answer to that. It happens in music, it happens in biology, it happens
like a talent. Is there a reason why certain people have these?
I always tell my students it's quite easy to think about to think outside the box once you know where the box is. So the trick is trying to figure out where the box is, and then you can think outside it.
And my second question is, let's say that this question is, I want to direct it to the philosopher. and let's say that everybody in the world like thought outside the box. What do you think about that? Like, would that spell the end for capitalism? I guess is what I'm trying to.
Then if you thought inside the box, you'd be a genius. You know, you'd be the one in a million. In the back, right there.
As you were writing your book, did you come up with sort of thoughts about how the meaning of equations changes in cultures? Because obviously, the way the Greeks thought about Pythagorean theorem is different from the way that we think about EMC squared. I mean, they didn't put it on a Christmas tree ornament, and we do. So how does the equation as a sort of concept or principle change in cultures through time?
That's actually that's a very, very interesting question. First of all, for the because you remember, for a lot of these equations, the inventors didn't write them down as equations the way that we know it. F equals ma, gm1 m2 over r squared, all those were written out by Newton in words, and they weren't put into equation form until equations themselves had to be discovered. The idea and each of the symbols too, the equal sign, originated at a certain particular point in history. The concept of addition, you know, if the ancient Egyptians had, you know, legs moving in one direction or another direction for signs for addition or subtraction, all of the very form of equations was something that had to be developed. But your question isn't quite about that. It's about the cultural meaning of it. But see, even for the Greeks, I said that other previous cultures, including Indian cultures, knew the rule of the Pythagorean theorem. But the people who began to be obsessed with actually proving it, that is making sure that it was legitimate and that you could pass on this proof to other people, were the Greeks. And that's a key moment in Western civilization, that is to focus your attention on how we know something, on not just what we know, but how we know it and how we know it for certain. So that's a bit of an answer to your question is that yes, there are different attitudes towards proving knowledge, but there's another interesting element there too, which is that equations can also be seductive. It looks like they can promise more certainty than they actually do, which is why you have in popular culture a lot of equations for coming up with things like, you know, the perfect sitcom or the perfect cereal, or practically every month some news magazine or other comes up with an equation for something. It seems to encapsulate knowledge, and so we tend to put our knowledge in that form in a way that often doesn't fit. I refer in this in the book to some equations that became symbols for either rationality or lack of rationality. 2 plus 2 is 4 is 1. I mean, during this
Soviet times, 2 + 2 = 5 was a famous equation, which is why Orwell uses it at the end of 1984 to indicate Winston's total submission to Big Brother, which is when he gives up the law of gravity and agrees that 2 + 2 = 5. What else? There are other ways in which equations often seduce us into trying to put knowledge that's unquantifiable into an equation form. Is that sort of an answer to what you're saying?
Down here we have a question.
Do you have any theories about why scientists are not included in history as generals are?
Well, that's an interesting question. That I try to address that in that when I'm riding my hobby horse at the end of that Maxwell chapter. In part, it has to do with the two cultures and the humanities trying to defend itself, kind of circle the wagons and defend a sphere of knowledge against the encroachment of sciences. But what I would hope for is a more fertile integration of the humanities with the sciences. But I think there are several reasons for it. That's what the last few pages of that particular chapter are about.
Let's see. How about right back here?
Are there people in either of your fields that are writing and using analogy, allegory, simile to describe these things, these concepts you're talking about, and translate them to a lay perspective? Some kind of a synergy between all of these things?
Well, the physicist Hermann Bondi said that the public would understand relativity when they had relativistic toys to play with. And I think there's a deep point to that, which is people who aren't scientists often have a very difficult time understanding scientific concepts unless they have something visual or something tactile that they can play with. So in this course that I'm teaching in quantum mechanics, the charge at the end of the course is basically try to imagine some sort of translation of the uncertainty principle into some other form. So, and students have written songs, they do videos, they've painted paintings in which they try to translate this concept from one form into another. But they're good scientific writers. I mean, Brian Greene is one of them who does a very good job. This person, historian of science David Lindley, in the book Uncertainty is another.
Nicholas Wade does a pretty good job, biological sciences. You know, part of the trouble is that analogies and similes and so on, when it comes to science, they superficially help, but they immediately run into problems when you try and get into a deeper explanation of things. Another factor, I think, is that science education, at least in the United States, is not particularly great. And so people have a hard time. They don't have as good a background as they might, I would say, maybe in some of the European countries like France and Germany. It's just actually harder to write more in-depth things that the public can understand, partly because of the education system. I don't know if you agree with that or not, but...
I think it's particularly difficult in quantum mechanics, where the whole idea of picturability is out the window. So it's totally difficult from the get-go.
It's a big problem, though. It's a big... Unfortunately, we only...
Have you ever seen Jim Blinn's series on computer graphics representation of all these subjects of... it's a visual representation. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they should be available on the web. Maybe YouTube, I don't know. Unfortunately, only two more, but we'll have time at the book signing for more. Okay, we've got two waving hands in the back here.
Hi, Thank you. I'm absolutely a lay person, but I've always been interested in certain philosophies of physics. Two things that I'm interested in, but I'm only going to ask you about one. I'm very interested in the super collider, the CERN, super collider CERN, and what they're doing there. And that relates to this philosophical scientific question about cosmology that someone mentioned earlier about the singularity of a black hole. I have a hypothesis that if it's true that matter, energy can neither be created nor destroyed, if all the energy that's being drawn into a black hole, something has to be happening. Either, in my mind, there's an outlet on the other side of a black hole where possibly energy is being taken through, or perhaps the energy is being stored within that singularity or that phenomenon. Either way, then my idea is, my thought is that the energy is going to do something. Something's going to happen. If it's stored, eventually it's going to be so much, something's going to happen. Maybe that might be the beginning of a black hole. Or maybe the energy is going out on the other side of a black hole. Again, maybe that might begin with a black hole of a Big Bang type of thing in another universe or begin another universe. I never asked anyone of your caliber that type of question. What's your thought about that?
I don't have that kind of caliber. I'm a philosopher, not a physicist. I think about it a lot, but actually you should ask that to a physicist.
Okay, one last question back here.
What do you think is the connection between a society's value of math and its effect on a society's mentality or collective unconscious?
Wow, that's another one I don't have the caliber to answer. What do you think? What do you...
Me, personally? My personal hypothesis would be that, like, you know, when a society has a high value on math, it creates an obsession with, like, evidence and statistics and logic behind an argument.
Yeah, putting evidence, putting things together, deductions between things. That's why for Plato you had to be a mathematician to enter the academy, even before you did philosophy.
Well, on that note, I want to thank everybody for coming tonight.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, Deloitte, K&L Gates, KPMG, Wallace Foundation, the Bujakci Foundation, Dean Hansel, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.